Welcome to Christ Church Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. Well, it's lovely to see you all here this morning. This morning we're starting our new sermon series. So over the last few months we've been looking at life prayers, we've been looking at different prayers, different people prayed in the Bible, and I found it really helpful. I hope you did too. But we're at the end of that now, and today we're starting our new sermon series, which we'll be going through all the way through summer on Exodus. And now when Andy told me that we were going to go through Exodus in our sermon series, I got really excited, probably because it made me think of all my favourite Sunday school stories, you know, like the burning bush and the 10 plagues and the parting of the Red Sea and, you know, the manna from heaven and all of that. But then when I started to look into it a bit more and started to think a bit about it a bit more, it very quickly dawned on me that there's probably a bit more to Exodus than just some of my Sunday school favourites, and that actually, yeah, there's a lot more to see than just those stories. And it made me think that I think Exodus is a little bit like one of my favourite cakes. One of my favourite cakes is a Bavarian classic. It's called Prinzregententorte, so there's a new German word for you. It won't be of any use unless you actually go to the south of Germany and go to Bavaria. Anywhere else, it won't be any use. But yeah, that's what it looks like. It's really tasty. And as you can see, there's just layers upon layers of cake mixture and chocolate cream. So traditionally, you have to have at least 8 layers of cake mixture and 8 layers of chocolate cream, okay? So, and if somebody said to me, okay, go ahead and make this cake, I'd feel really overwhelmed. I'd feel like, oh, I don't even know where to start. And I think it's a little bit like that with Exodus, that actually there's lots and lots of layers to the book of Exodus. Because on one layer, on the surface, you know, Exodus is the story of how God brings Israel out of slavery, out of Egypt, into on a journey into the promised land. But then on another layer, you know, it's more than just the story of God's relationship with Israel. It's actually also about the relationship God has with us. So that's another layer. And then, you know, if we go even deeper than that, you know, we see that actually it's not just about the relationship God has with Israel or the relationship God has with us, but it's also about who God is and his character and the promises he's made to Israel and the promises that now apply to us as well. So we can already see that there's lots of different layers and lots of different meaning and references. And as we go through the book of Exodus, actually, we see that lots of the themes, lots of the meanings we will pick out actually then kind of run like a red thread through the rest of the Bible. And so if you were to kind of summarize all of that now, I read this quote by one of the commentators and I found that really helpful. He said, Exodus is essentially a book about knowing God through personal experience. Exodus is essentially a book about knowing God through personal experience. And I think even though there's all these different layers, you know, I think that's a really good summary. And I hope that's what we'll experience over the next few months as we go through the book, that, you know, we will get to know more of who God is and learn more about his character. And, you know, by looking at the experiences that Israel went through, that we will be able to apply some of that to our lives and learn from that, and that we will just, yeah, experience God in a new way. So that's my hope for this series. But I thought before we will start to look at our passage for today, which is chapter 1 and 2, I thought it'd be good to start with a little bit of background and context to Exodus. Now, question, who here is currently hooked to a TV series? Who's currently watching a TV series that they really like? Anybody? Anybody brave enough to share in church what they're watching? No? Okay. So I guess most of us have watched some kind of TV series or are watching something currently. And so I think most of us will probably have had that conversation where somebody will say, oh, I've just finished such and such a TV series and it was really good and now I really need a new TV series. And then, you know, and I would ask you, oh, can you can you recommend anything? And then most likely you would say, oh, you really should watch this or you should watch that. I had this conversation with Hannah the other day. She told me to watch Bones. Yeah, great. But I guess, so most of us have probably had a conversation like that, but I'm assuming that if you told me to watch a certain TV series, you'd assume that I would start at the beginning, right? You would assume that I'd start with season one and not somewhere halfway through season three. And so I think it's a bit like that with Exodus, in the sense that you can look at Exodus as season two out of five seasons, which are called the Pentateuch, which are the first five books of the Bible. Who can name them? Exodus. It starts with Genesis, Exodus, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So that's the, you know, if you like, the five seasons. And so if we are looking at Exodus now, you know, it would be really helpful if we kind of in our own time actually read season one, if you like, Genesis, because we'll see even in our passage today that there's loads of references being made in Exodus that actually refer back to Genesis. So it's, you know, so if you're going home, you know, tonight and you're sitting down in front of a TV and you want to watch your favorite TV show or whatever, just think, oh, you know what? Actually, I could read Genesis instead of watching, and then that will help us as we go through Exodus. Yeah, so we will see as we go through the passage today even that there's loads of references in Exodus that go back to Genesis. And we see that actually in the first few verses in chapter 1. So if we start reading chapter 1, verse 1, it says this. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Okay, so we read these first verses, and we see that Exodus pretty much seamlessly continues where Genesis finished. And so we have to go back to Genesis to understand what's going on and who these people are. So if we go back to Genesis 12, we see that God picks out a guy called Abraham, and he says to Abraham that he will make him into a great nation, he will bless him, and that all the peoples on earth will be blessed through him. So we see that in Genesis 12, 2 and 3. And so that's really important for us to remember, because actually we'll see some of the fulfillment of that promises as we go through Exodus. So, okay, so God picks out this guy, Abraham, and he says, I'll make you into a great nation. Now, Abraham and his wife, they're far too old to have children, but God miraculously gives them a son. And then the son is called Isaac. Then Isaac goes on to have a son called Jacob. Jacob, to make things even more complicated, is also called Israel. So Jacob, aka Israel, has then 12 sons. And you can see this in the, I've got a little family tree here. So you can just see it all starts with Abraham, and then we get to Isaac, Jacob, and then the 12 sons of Jacob. Now, one of Jacob's sons is Joseph, and most of us probably know the story that Joseph is sold into slavery in Egypt by his brothers, but through God's grace, he becomes the second most powerful man in the country. And then when there is a famine where Jacob and his sons live, they come to Egypt to buy food. They're being reunited with Joseph. You know, there's forgiveness and reconciliation after many years. And then Joseph says to his dad and his brothers, he says, why don't you come and live in Egypt with me? So they all move to Egypt, Jacob, his sons, and all of their families. And this is where we now continue in Exodus. So they've all moved to Egypt, lived happily ever after, if you like, and have grown and grown and grown and have started to become into a nation. So then we continue with our passage in verse 8, where it says, then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labour and brick and mortar, and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labour, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every Hebrew boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. And then most of us know how the story goes. Pharaoh's daughter finds the basket, rescues Moses, takes him in, and technically Pharaoh becomes Moses' granddad. And so Moses grows up in Pharaoh's family, and then many years later, we continue reading in verse 11. "One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, 'Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?' The man said, 'Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and thought, 'What I did must have become known.' When Pharaoh heard this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well." And then the story continues. Moses spends many years in Midian. He finds a new family. He gets married. He has children. And then the chapter just ends with these few verses in 23. "During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them." Okay, so that's our passage for today. Now, I think when we read the Bible, or maybe especially the Old Testament, it can be quite easy for us to read it in quite an emotionally detached and distant way. But actually, if we really take in what these verses are saying, it's pretty horrific, isn't it? You know, there's slavery, there's oppression, there's genocide, you know, babies being torn away from their mother's arms and drowned in the Nile on a daily basis. You know, I think if we just really imagine what horror and trauma the Israelites went through on a, you know, daily basis for many years they lived through this. And so I think if we really take this in, probably most of us can't help but think, okay, where is God in all of this? Why would he let this happen? You know, how could a good God let something like that happen and just watch and not intervene? And I think it's really interesting that actually, as we read the first two chapters, you know, God isn't really mentioned much at all. So we really do get that feeling of, where is God? You know, he seems so distant, and it feels like he's abandoned his people. And I think that can be our experience a lot of the times as well, can't it? I'm sure many of us, when we look at the news and we see all the suffering and the pain, you know, we think, God, why are you letting this happen? You know, where are you? And I'm sure most of us have had experiences in our own lives where we felt, God, where are you? Why are you not doing anything about this? And maybe, you know, some of us might be in that place today where we're really struggling and we feel like, God, why are you not answering? Why are you not doing something about this? And yeah, and I think that can be a really difficult place. And I think what might make it even more difficult, I think, is that since we've you know, we've got Google and smartphones. We are pretty much used to having any question answered within seconds. You know, anything you want to know, no matter how trivial, you can have an answer in seconds. You know, it just happened to me yesterday. I wanted to bake some scones or scones or whatever you call it. And I went to the shop and I thought, oh, I need some baking powder. And then I looked at the shelf and right next to the baking powder was bicarbonate of soda. And I thought, oh, what's the difference? I don't know. So I got my phone out and checked. And even the week before, I had a bit of a cold and it just wouldn't go away for ages, which made me think, oh, maybe it's a sinus infection. So what did I do? Got my phone out and Googled, what's the difference between a cold and a sinus infection? And Google was very helpful and helped me to self-diagnose. And I realized, oh, I think I might have a sinus infection. And so I think, you know, we do this all the time where we're just wondering about, oh, what's the weather going to be? Or, you know, where shall I go on holiday? Or, you know, whatever it is, we just get our phones out and we'll get the answer we're looking for. And I think even on a more serious level, this happens as well. You know, whenever there's a tragic accident or a tragic incident, you know, like the killing in Ireland of the Irish journalist in Londonderry, you know, whenever something like that happens, immediately we hear officials talk about things like the families deserve to know, the families have a right to know what happened, the families deserve to have answers. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think in our culture, it feels like we've kind of almost made a human right out of knowing. You know, we deserve to know, we have a right to know everything, to have answers to every question we might have. And I think if we have that attitude and then approach God in the Bible, we're in difficulties because when we read the Bible, we don't always get the answers we're looking for, or we don't always get answers within seconds. So I think that maybe sometimes our culture or that kind of sense that we have a right to know, we have a right to understand everything, doesn't always help when we approach God in the Bible. But I think what is encouraging is that when we look at the Bible, that actually the Bible doesn't shy away or doesn't try to cover up the fact that a lot of us, a lot of humans, feel at times that God has abandoned us or that God isn't with us. And so, you know, the Bible doesn't pretend that people don't feel like that. The Bible doesn't pretend that that's not part of our human experience. And I think most importantly, the Bible doesn't condemn us when we have doubts or when we feel like, God, where are you? Why are you not doing something about this? And in fact, we actually see lots of examples in the Bible of people who experience similar things. You know, we read of Job and King David and the prophet Jeremiah, who all at times felt like God had abandoned them, or who were asking, God, where are you? Why are you not doing anything about this? So I think it's just important for us to recognize that actually this kind of struggling and doubting is part of our Christian walk. And the beautiful thing is that as a church family, you know, we're here to help each other and to support each other through those doubts and through those struggles. So if we go back to our text, you know, we've already discovered that it feels like, you know, God is very silent, God is very distant. It doesn't really mention much about God at all in the first few chapters. Until actually we get to chapter 3 next week, where God speaks very clearly and very directly. But in our two chapters, there isn't much of that at all. But I think, nonetheless, we can get little hints, or we can see little glimpses that actually, despite all the suffering, despite all the apparent silence of God, God is always in control, he's always present, and he's always fulfilling his promises. And I think that's what I just want us to focus on this morning, the fact that God is always in control, he's always present, and he's always fulfilling his promises. And I think I'm just going to pick out some examples from the text where I think we can see that, or, you know, where we can find a bit of evidence that is true. So I think the first example we see is in chapter 1, verse 12, where it talks about the fact that despite their oppression, the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied and kept spreading. And so we see that, you know, the promise we looked at earlier, the promise God made to Abraham that he would turn him into, you know, make him into a great nation. We can see that in these verses, God is starting to fulfill that promise. God is making Israel into a great nation. And it's maybe not the circumstances that we would choose or the circumstances we would pick, but nonetheless, we can see that God is fulfilling his promise. in those situations. And I think another example we see in the text is of the two midwives, you know, that God protects them, even though, you know, they disobey Pharaoh. God protects them, and he actually blesses their faithfulness, and he blesses them with families of their own. So we see again that even in all the suffering, God is still involved and kind of, working things out. I think another really good example of that is the miraculous rescue of baby Moses. You know, isn't it funny how he gets rescued by the same people who tried to kill him, and then is brought up in Pharaoh's household? And we see even in those few verses that talk about the rescue of baby Moses, we see lots of references that go back to events in Genesis again, and we see we kind of get a taste of what is going to happen further on in Exodus and in the history of Israel. So already there's lots of kind of, you know, threads, and you can see how God is kind of weaving all of those threads into kind of using them to kind of create human story, I guess. And we can just see that God is in control of all of that and kind of weaving it all together. And then I think the final example of the fact that God is always in control, always present, and always fulfilling his promises, we see that the most clearly at the end of chapter 2, where it says that their cry for help because of the slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. So it tells us that God hears them and sees them. And I think, you know, when you first read those verses, it sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? It sounds like God has forgotten about Israel, and all of a sudden he remembers, you know, the way you forget about somebody's birthday and then you remember, oh, it was their birthday, I should have sent a birthday card, but now it's too late. But it's not like that with God. But it does sound a bit odd when we first read it. But again, we need to go back to Genesis to actually find out why it makes sense. Because we read in Genesis 15 that God had actually told Abraham that this would happen, that many years after Abraham, his people would suffer. So it says in Genesis 15, it says, "The Lord said to Abraham, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions." So we see here at the end of chapter 2 in Exodus that God had actually predicted that this would happen. And it's almost like now at the end of chapter 2, God is saying, okay, those 400 years are over now. Now the time has come for me to act. Now the time has come for me to free my people and to punish the people who've enslaved them. So it's like now the time that God has predestined, if you like, has come, and now God is going to act. And I guess for me, the challenge is when I read this, is to accept that, you know, God is outside of time and space, and that even in the midst of all the pain and suffering, even when it's hard to see, even when I don't understand why all of this is going on, and I'm not provided with quick answers, even in all of that, God is always present, always in control, and always fulfilling his promises. And because I think it's quite easy to read that and to kind of, I mean, that was my first thought, to think, well, why would you do that? Why would you just, you know, even tell Abraham, well, you know, your descendants will suffer for 400 years. Why would you do that? And I don't know if you're anything like me. I think I can often find myself almost say to God, well, I wouldn't do it that way. You know, if I were God, I wouldn't do it this way. But if, of course, you know, we have to accept that we're not God, and it's not always easy to accept that, but, you know, ultimately his perspective is just so much bigger than ours. And it's a bit like, I've got a picture of Beetham Tower, you know, the Hilton Hotel in Manchester. So it was the biggest building in Manchester, now it's the second biggest building. But has anybody here been up to, you know, the restaurant on kind of halfway up on the 23rd level? Yes, it's good, isn't it? It's the most expensive coffee you'll ever drink, but it's really good. And on a nice day, I know you don't get many of those in Manchester, but on a nice day, you can see for miles. And the view is just stunning, isn't it? You can see Old Trafford, you can see, Salford Quays, you can see the airport, you can just see so much. And then you look down and you see all the little cars and all the little people, you know, kind of rushing around. And you just realize that you have a completely different perspective to those people on the ground. And, you know, and to some, I mean, it's just an illustration, but to some extent, that's how it is with God. And we just have to get our heads around it that, you know, God's perspective is just so different. And we're just these tiny little people, you know, just rushing around. And we can't see as far as he can see. And I think, you know, the best way to put it is we find in Isaiah 55 verses 8 and 9, where God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So we see in the first two chapters of Exodus that God is in control of time and space and everything else. He's always present. He's always fulfilling his promises, even when it doesn't feel like it. And I think the extent to which we believe that will then lead us to two different responses. So I think the extent to which we believe that God is always in control, always present, and always fulfilling his promises, the extent to which we believe that will either lead us to trust God more or to try and be God. And I'll explain that just as we come to a close now. So I think a good example of trusting God and, you know, in the midst of all of that are the midwives. So, you know, it says that they feared God more than Pharaoh. And I think it's so easy to overlook their courage and their bravery and their faithfulness. You know, here's the most powerful man in the world, and he tells them, go and kill all the baby boys. But it says that the midwives feared God more than they feared the king of Egypt or what he could do to them. So they don't go and kill all the baby boys. And then when he summons them and is asking, why haven't you done as I told? They must have known that their lives were on the line. They must have known that they were risking their lives by disobeying Pharaoh. And they must have known that at any instant, Pharaoh could just kill them. But instead, God protects them. You know, instead, they stay alive. And not only that, but God also blesses them with families of their own, with children of their own. And I think just, you know, those little verses about those few verses about the midwives really challenge me to, to kind of trust in God, even when, in dark times, and to stay faithful. But also challenges me to look at blessings, that the way God blesses us, even in dark times, because we can see that here, can't we, that even in, even in really difficult circumstances, God still blesses those midwives. And I think he does that with us as well a lot of the times, you know, even in our hard times, in our struggles, God still blesses us in many ways, and we can still see God's blessings in our lives. It made me think of some of the work I do, with students who struggle with uni and with life and with mental health and all of that. And sometimes when you talk to them and when it's appropriate, and, you know, they're just so kind of inward looking and just overwhelmed with everything that's going on, I'll just say to them, okay, give me 10 things you're grateful for, 10 things you're thankful for. And usually I get blank faces and, you know, no answers really. And then, you know, I'll say things like, well, how about we start with being grateful that we don't live in a war zone, or the fact that we've got running water and electricity and food and a roof over our heads and all of that. And I just think, you know, it's a really good exercise for us that even when times are hard or even when we're struggling, to actually train ourselves to look for God's blessings and to look for the things we can be grateful for. So I think that's one way we can respond. And that's how we should respond to the fact that, you know, God is present, God is in control, and he's fulfilling his promises. But I think what often can happen when we don't, or maybe when we struggle to believe that, is that we become a bit more like Moses at the end of chapter 2, where he responds quite differently. You know, he sees all the suffering, he sees all the oppression, and he wants to help, and he wants to change things. And so he wants to rescue his people from oppression. But he's trying to do that without God. So he's kind of charging in, he's trying to, you know, to free the people, but on his own, in his own strength. He's not rescuing anybody. He's not bringing any hope, any freedom, any change at all. So Moses gets into a lot of trouble. God leads him into the wilderness, where he then, after many years, powerfully experiences God and God's presence. And through that experience, he his heart is changed, he's humbled. And after meeting with God in a really powerful way, he's then becomes the person who can then rescue Israel out of slavery. And I think it's often true for us as well, isn't that we see at the problems in our own lives and we think, right, we're just going to fix this. You know, we look at our own lives or our families or work, and we just think we're going to use all our resources, our influence, our abilities, whatever it is, and we think, right, I'm going to fix this. And I think also as a church, this can happen. You know, we look at all the problems in our society, we look at all the issues we have and we think, right, we're going to fix this. We're going to reduce child poverty. We're going to reduce discrimination. We're going to tackle, human trafficking. We're going to tackle loneliness, homelessness, and all of that. We're just going to pull all our resources together, think really hard, and then we'll come up with a solution and we'll fix things. But of course, that doesn't always work so well. And I think, Andy mentioned it earlier, but I think when Colin spoke at the Weekend Away about how desperately we need God's presence and God's power, I think that's where we need to start, rather than trying to fix things. You know, that the only way we will see lasting change is through God's presence and God's power. And if we don't have that, we'll just be like Moses, trying to fix things in our own strength, and it's not going to last, and it's not actually going to produce lasting change. And I think as I was preparing for this, I was kind of thinking about a story in my own life where maybe I've experienced that. And I was thinking about my dad, who's been, I don't know, many of you might know, who's been in a wheelchair for many, many years now. And I remember when I was about 12 or 13, I read this newspaper article where it was talking about this new treatment for people who are paralyzed and who can't walk, and this new treatment would help them to actually learn to walk. And so I read this newspaper article and I thought, this is great. I ran to my dad and said, right, we can fix this. We can get you out of this wheelchair. We'll just get you to those doctors, hospitals, whatever. And, it'll be fixed and it'll be fine, and we'll be able to do all the things that we haven't been able to do. And I thought, it's as easy as that. We can just fix things. And then when my dad told me that his injury was quite different and that actually that treatment wouldn't work for him, I guess I realized for the first time that sometimes you just can't fix things. You can't. And, when I look at my dad now, it is heartbreaking because, he's in so much pain, chronic pain every day. And so many times, you wonder, why does God let this happen? Why is he making my dad suffer like this? But, it's interesting because what I've learned even from just looking at Exodus is that even though I look at my dad and there's so much suffering and so much pain and it's been going on for so many years, actually, I can see a lot of blessings as well. And if you'd ask him, he would say the same thing. Even though he's been in a wheelchair for so many years and can't walk, he's always been able to work full time and provide for his family. He's got great kids and he's got, he lives in a country where there's really good healthcare and, he's really well looked after and all of that. So even in the suffering and in the pain, there is actually a lot of blessings as well. And the interesting thing is I've never heard my dad actually say, oh, God can't be good because he's letting me suffer like this. And so I think if you spoke to my dad, he would actually say that, yes, actually, it's true. God is always in control. He's always present and he's always fulfilling his promises, even when we can't see it. Even when we don't understand why things are happening, or even when we don't understand why God isn't answering prayers, because of course we've prayed many times that he would get healed, but it hasn't happened and we haven't got the answers of why. But I can still, in my dad, I think I can still see that it is true that God is always in control, always present, and always fulfilling his promises. And so as we come to an end, I just want to look back at the promise we looked at the beginning, the promise that God made to Abraham, where he said to Abraham in Genesis 12 that he would make him into a great nation, he would bless him, and all the peoples on the earth would be blessed through him. And what's really exciting is that We are, all of us, are the fulfillment of the last part of that promise. So when God says, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you, that's us. I think that's pretty cool. Because many centuries after God promised those promises to Abraham, and you know, many centuries after he made Israel into a great nation, Jesus came. And through Jesus, all peoples of the earth are blessed. Because through Jesus, everybody can know who God is. Through Jesus, everybody can be forgiven. Everybody can be made right with God. Through Jesus, we can have a relationship with God. You know, through Jesus, we can know that despite all the suffering and in the pain around us, that God is in control and he's present and that he will keep his promises. And through Jesus, all the promises that God made to Israel now apply to us. So that means through Jesus, you know, we are promised that God will always be with us, that he will never leave us. We're promised that God loves us and that he's going to look after us. And most importantly, we're promised that, you know, one day everything will be made right. You know, one day there will be a day when there's no more suffering and no more pain, when there's no more conflict, no more tears, no more sadness, and no more death. And so, so I think, you know, that's just through Jesus, we have all of that. And so we can just see how through Jesus, all the promises, you know, the promises we've looked at today and the promises we'll look at as we go through Exodus, all apply to us as well now.